While facial coverings can simply be uncomfortable and can make breathing difficult, the CDC and the government of the U.S. Virgin Islands recommend using masks when you are out in public to stop the spread of COVID-19. Wearing a mask is a requirement to enter any business in the USVI. Use your mask safely with appropriate hand hygiene. Check for holes or tears. Cover your face and mouth snugly. Make sure you can breathe easily. And be extra careful not to touch the front of your mask and any part of your face while removing it. Wash your hands and your mask after each use. And when you can, please stay at home and leave only for brief and essential areas. Avoid going out on really hot days when breathing can be difficult. Use a cloth mask or homemade covering made of light, breathable fabric. And take a break if you are ever feeling breathless. Remember, masks protect you and they protect others. As we all work together to fight COVID-19, tell your friends, tell your family, and remind our visitors that no mask means no service.
Wash your hands, avoid sick people, and touching your face. There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Visit cdc.gov/COVID-19. Brought to you by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
WTJX 93.1 Charlotte Amalia, your NPR station in the Virgin Islands.
This is a WTJX News Brief. The whole community has to come together. We all have a part to play in stopping or at least slowing down the spread of the COVID-19.
We can all play a part in reducing the spread of COVID-19 by wearing a mask. Masks would provide an extra layer to help prevent your respiratory droplets from traveling into the air and onto other people. We at the Department of Health recommend that you wear a mask in public and adhere to the requirement to enter any business in the Virgin Islands. You can help to reduce the spread of COVID-19 by following the simple steps. Wear a mask that covers your nose and mouth to help protect others in case you're infected with COVID-19 but don't have symptoms. COVID-19 can be spread by people who do not have symptoms and do not know that they are infected. Wear a mask in public settings when around people who don't live in your household, especially when it may be difficult for you to stay 6 feet apart. Wear a mask when you're caring for someone sick at home. Wear a mask correctly for maximization of protection. Masks should not be worn by children under the age of 2. Anyone who has trouble breathing due to acute illnesses. Anyone who can't take off a mask without help from another person, for example, if someone is unconscious or paralyzed. Remember, masks reduce the spray of droplets when worn over the nose and mouth. Wear masks in public when around people you don't live in your home with, households, or where social distancing is difficult to maintain.
Governor Bryan expresses the importance that everyone cooperate with the 2020 census workers who are back on the job.
One of the things we're going to be doing, the Census Bureau, their contractors and workers are allowed now to go out and continue with the census taking. Please be safe. There's ways now you can fill out the census online as well too. If they call you on the phone, please be responsive. This is all our money for the next 10 years. So the counts that we get now will determine how much money we get in aid, what our poverty line would look like, what kind of housing subsidies we're going to get. So much is tied to this, and it's so important.
There's fiber optic cable being laid on St. Croix from Plaza Extra East towards Constitution Road, then from Beeston Hill Medical Center towards Herman Hill. That's going on now through September 8th, 9 to 5. Expect delays due to partial road closures and lane closures, and use a little caution in those areas. Department of Public Works advising the public while Vitran's fixed route service is suspended. Residents will see buses on the roadway starting yesterday. They're being used for mass transit bus operator training purposes only, and it's going to continue until the 4th of September. Now, Vitran continues to provide ADA paratransit services to passengers traveling for dialysis and medical care.
Support for NPR comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the ECMC Foundation, working to improve post-secondary educational outcomes for underserved students through evidence-based innovation. Learn more at ecmcfoundation.org.
That's your WTJX News Brief. I'm Doug Harris. The views and opinions expressed on Analyze This are entirely those of the on-air participants and do not reflect that of the station's board, management, staff, or underwriters.
And we are back for hour number two on what is September Day, because it's September the 1st, you know, like in May. On May 1st, we always call it May Day. So this is September Day, and at this point, we're going to change the discussion. We're going to move away from local finances, and we're going to start talking about weather. And just when we started doing that, it started raining here on St. Croix. We've got Mr. Eric J. Dolan, an award-winning author and historian with an academic background in environmental policy. He's joining us from his home in Marblehead, Massachusetts. His newest book, A Furious Sky, The 500-Year History of America's Hurricanes, came out last month, and he joins us now on the eve of peak hurricane season from his home up in New England. Good morning, Mr. Dolan. How are you?
Good morning. I'm fine. How are you?
Everything is good. Where is Marblehead? If I'm on the 95, if I'm on the 95 and I got to get off and take the 90 to head into Boston, where am I going from there?
You have to go a little further north than Boston. A lot of people say about Marblehead, it's very hard to get here. Basically, if you're in Boston, it's 20 miles to the north and slightly to the east. It's right on the coast. It's in between Boston and Gloucester, Massachusetts, which a lot of people have heard about. It's a small town. It's only about a mile square. It's got about 19,000 people right on the coast. A lot of history. We were founded in 1629. A lot of fishing history and maritime history. It's really a beautiful place.
Now,
just like where you are.
Yeah, definitely. Now, before we get into the details of the book, you just mentioned the name of a town, right? What is it about Massachusetts where you have these towns that are spelt with three syllables but pronounced with two syllables? Because you just said Gloucester, and I know it's spelled Gloucester. Like Worcester is pronounced Wooster. What's up with you Boston? And that, because you guys don't say oh, Boston. What's up with you Boston people
that you just
throw caution to the wind and kick out the second syllable? What's up with that?
Yeah, it's a good point. I don't know. I'm not an etymologist. I don't know the history of words, but people in Massachusetts, I'm not originally from Massachusetts. I'm from New York, but I don't have much of an accent of either place.
You sound like New York.
Okay.
And we have something in common because I'm from New York as well. Born in New York, but I'm a local. I'm a homie. I'm an island boy,
okay.
So it is what it is. Okay, so now that we've gotten the English class and the grammar class out of the way, and I learned the word etymologist. That's the word.
Etymologist.
So Mr. Engineer,
yeah.
Make a note of that, and Ms. Producer, make a note of that as well. We learned a word here today, even though we're supposed to be talking about hurricanes. Now, the 500 year history of America's hurricanes. Now, when you say America's, you mean America the nation, or the Americas to include the Caribbean region as well as America?
Well, I have a fair amount about the Caribbean in there, but I tried to focus the book just on hurricanes over the past 500 years, pretty much that have hit places that are now part of the United States. That's essentially the defining characteristic. So there are a lot of hurricanes that hit Caribbean nations that aren't really talked about because it wasn't within the scope of the book. I had to draw the line somewhere. And another line that I had to draw is if you do a book that is 500 years worth of hurricanes, there are a lot of hurricanes that don't make it into the book. So I know that I can get complaints from people that their favorite hurricane or the hurricane that hit their area didn't make it into the book, but it's more a popular narrative history that uses key hurricanes over time to tell a broader story about American history.
No. Which hurricane are we starting with in this 500-year history?
The first one is the one that Christopher Columbus encountered in 1502. As everybody knows, Christopher Columbus made four voyages to what was called back then the New World. During the first three voyages, he didn't encounter what we would call a hurricane. He was on the edge of some big storms, but he also, in between treating the natives quite poorly, he also talked to many of them, and they told him of these massive storms, the likes of which Europeans hadn't experienced, and they told him some of the signs to keep an eye on, sort of a red sky in the morning, broad, deep swells coming in off the ocean, high cirrus clouds, animals acting strangely. And Christopher Columbus took note of this information. So in 1502, when he came over with four ships in his final voyage, he was told by King Ferdinand and Isabella to stay away from Hispaniola, not to go into Santo Domingo, because he had a bad reputation there for sure. And the governor didn't like him there either, Governor Ovando. But the problem is, when Christopher Columbus made it to Hispaniola, he saw all the signs of this massive storm that he had heard about. So he begged Governor Ovando to let him bring his ships into the harbor. But Governor Ovando refused, and then Columbus also told him that you shouldn't let that treasure fleet that you're sending off to Spain leave. There are 28 vessels filled with all the gold and silver that the Spanish had taken from the natives in Central and South America, essentially, and they were sending it back to Spain.
Mm-hmm.
So Columbus begged him not to send this fleet off because he was self-interested, basically. I mean, he knew this storm, or he thought he knew this storm was coming, and one of the ships was this small ship called the Aguja, or the Needle. It had on board the money that King Ferdinand and his Queen Isabella had promised Columbus for his earlier work in the region. So he didn't want all of his money going to the bottom of the ocean. Well, Governor Ovando, you know, totally discounted anything that Columbus said, sent the fleet off, and soon thereafter, the hurricane roared in and sank all of the ships but four. Three of the ships hobbled, made it back to Santo Domingo, and one ship, Columbus's ship, the Aguja, made it to Spain with all of his money. And so people look back at the prediction that Columbus had made, and people called him a sorcerer. How did he know this storm was coming? And they thought it was retribution for how he'd been treated before, because one of the guys on one of the ships that went down who died, this guy named Bobadilla, was a magistrate in Santo Domingo who had put Christopher Columbus on trial during his last voyage there, the last time he was there, and found him guilty of a whole bunch of heinous acts and sent him back to Spain in chains. So people thought that this is Columbus getting back at somebody that had, you know, done something bad to him, a sort of revenge. The other thing, the good news for Columbus, is he was smart. He didn't just stay outside of Santo Domingo. He went along the coast, and he found another embayment to shelter, and he wrote about his experience, and his son did, how the ships were parted, and they almost sank, but they all made it through the hurricane. So he has the distinction of being the first Westerner, the first European to ever make a weather prediction in the New World, and it happened to be an accurate one. So I just thought that was a great story.
It is a great story, and you said that they thought that he was a sorcerer because
yeah.
because they figured he predicted this, but clearly we deal with that on an annual basis. It's a seasonal thing, you know.
Well, the people who were already there, I mean, history books are much better now, but it used to be sort of this assumption that the Westerners came to the New World, came to North America and South America and Central America, and nothing was really there, no indigenous knowledge, whatever.
We know that's not
cultures,
true.
Yeah, there are native cultures that were there and very familiar with hurricanes. The only thing that's unfortunate is the written record from back then. It would be great to find out more, and I didn't find out more. Maybe it's out there, but more direct information from those cultures about how they handled these hurricanes, which were annual occurrences for them. Whether they went to, caves on islands, or they had protective shelters, or they just were battered like everybody else and had to rebuild after the hurricane came through.
Okay, that's interesting. I like that as a foundation for the discussion, yeah. Right? So that's the hurricane that we're going to use as the genesis for the 500 year, right? That we're talking about.
That was the beginning. And then after that, ever since, certainly the Westerners that were coming to the Caribbean and in the 1500s and certainly in the 1600s, 1700s, and then as we get into the colonial era of the United States, all of these people that settled in this part of the world became quite familiar with hurricanes. And they all thought that hurricanes were, you know, God's work, and nobody quite knew when they were going to arise or what was going to happen other than the annual season. And the hurricanes that we have history about, like the great colonial hurricane of 1635, it nearly, you know, wiped out part of the Plymouth colony and the Massachusetts Bay colony, killed many Native Americans, killed many of the colonists, destroyed a lot of their houses, and was really a terrible event. And you get this history over and over again of these hurricanes roaring in and basically rearranging the local history. And even to today, one of the things that was fascinating to me in working on this book is talking to people who had lived through major hurricanes or reading what they write about it. So many people measured their life, you know, before Katrina and after Katrina, before Irma and after Irma. And I know Hurricane Irma really did a number on the part of the Virgin Islands. People, it gets seared into their memory because their lives can be totally upended by these hurricanes.
No, the thing that I wanted to ask, because you mentioned these storms that hit up in the Northeast, right?
Yeah.
In 1995, I was in New York. Well, Maryland hit us in September that year. And when I took vacation later that year, October into November, I experienced a nor'easter for the first time while I was up in New York in November. So the question that I'm asking is, the majority of these hurricanes, it's the same hurricane cycle, hurricane season that exists here in the Caribbean?
Yeah.
The hurricanes that you referenced that hit, like the 1635 hitting Massachusetts all late summer, early fall?
Yeah, that was in October. I mean, it goes till the end of the hurricane season. So the hurricanes that hit up here in New England, where I am, we get hit much less frequently than you do, of course. Only about 5 to 10 hurricanes make landfall in New England and roughly New York every century. So it's not that frequent. We get the remnants of a lot of hurricanes. But yeah, if it's a warm core storm that started, you know, either in the Atlantic, came up from the Caribbean, or started in the Gulf of Mexico, they don't usually make it up to the Northeast. But basically, it has to be a warm core storm. A nor'easter is like a hurricane in a sense, but it's cold core and has different characteristics and often happens in the middle of winter here. But they can be just as devastating as hurricanes. You can get 75, 80-mile-an-hour winds, 90-mile-an-hour winds in nor'easters. But I don't know the specific hurricane you're talking about in 95. I have to admit,
Maryland.
I don't know every single hurricane.
Hurricane Maryland. Okay.
Oh, it was Maryland that hit up here? Okay.
Here's what we'll establish in this conversation, right? You will have your way with me up to 1989. But from Hugo, then I'll have fun with you. You know what I'm saying? Well, actually, from 1979, because we had hurricanes David and Frederick. Even though they didn't hit us, they brought a tremendous amount of rain. So from 79 to now, which is about 41 years, we are pretty much paranoid this time of year, simply because the level of devastation, whether it be wind, whether it be rain, whether it be a combination of the two,
right?
We have our historical, landmarks, so to speak, hits in this case, not landmarks, land hits. With respect.
Oh, absolutely.
With respect to that.
It doesn't have to be a hurricane. You know, it was funny, a couple of weeks ago, actually, when the book came out on August 4th, Hurricane Isaias came up the coast and became a tropical storm and caused a lot of damage in the Northeast when it was a tropical storm. And what people need to realize is, even if something's not officially a hurricane or gets downgraded from a hurricane to a tropical storm, if you have a storm coming through that's dumping 8, 10, 12, 13 inches of rain and has winds of 60 miles an hour,
that's significant.
That can be devastating.
Yeah, that's significant. We're going to take our first break right about now. When we come back, we're going to talk about the hurricanes hitting the Northeast, and then we'll talk about the hurricanes hitting us here in the region, and your book. Continue to talk about your book as well. Eric J. Dolan on the line. We'll be right back after this break.
We believe in the power of community. When Hurricanes Irma and Maria destroyed the islands, we were there to assist families who suffered financial hardships. When nonprofit organizations are in need of support, we are there to provide financial assistance so that they can continue to advocate for the causes important to our community. And now, when COVID-19 is forcing most businesses to close their doors, we are providing critical funding so they will not lose their businesses.
Okay, est-ce que vous connaissez la différence qui gagne entre Medicare avec Medicaid? Medicare, c'est assurance santé pour les gens qui gagnent 65 ans ou trois plus. Avec les gens qui gagnent n'importe l'âge, qui gagnent maladie rein, qui arrivent face terminale. Medicaid, c'est un programme qui aide à payer les dépenses Medicaid. Tout pas travail pour assez l'argent et pour satisfaire l'autre condition. Allez sur Medicare.gov qui est 1-800-Medicare pour plus d'informations.
Hi, this is Steve Inskeep. When you roll out of bed, bleary-eyed and groggy, if you're like me, the first thing on your mind is getting something to wake you up. So turn on the radio. NPR's daily news program, Morning Edition, has been working through the night to get you the news you need. It's as essential to your morning as a good cup of coffee. So hit the ground running by listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition at 5 a.m. weekdays on WTJX-FM, 93.1 NPR in the Virgin Islands.
And we're back. And of course, this is Analyze This, 93.1 FM. I've got Mr. Eric J. Dolan here on the line. A furious guy. The 500-year history of America's hurricanes. So now you're talking about the Northeast, right?
That's part of what I talk about.
I agree. That's my fault. One of the areas we're talking about, because we're definitely going to touch the Caribbean and all that stuff. But there's three in particular. You made a statement where you said typically the Northeast gets, 10 storms per decade?
No, they get 5 to 10 hurricanes a century.
Five to ten hurricanes a century. Okay.
A century.
Well, yeah. Yeah. Well, that's changed, and I've got proof that that's not the case. But we'll see. Maybe there is something to global warming, right? Here's a perfect example, right? And Irene, 2011, mm-hmm. August 2011, hits New York, Brooklyn, right? I'm sure I'll just call them off and they'll come to you.
You got to keep in mind when I said 5 to 10, I was talking about New England where I am.
Exactly. But keep in mind, New England starts with Connecticut.
Yes, and it's landfall. You measure them by landfall. In terms of us getting hit or affected by a hurricane, Hurricane Sandy, for example, which made landfall in New Jersey,
yes,
and did a real number on New Jersey and New York,
yeah,
it also greatly affected Marblehead, where I am. It was a thousand-mile-wide storm, but that's my point. Not officially one of the 5 to 10 hurricanes.
But
it has to be landfall, which is when the eye of the storm intersects the coast.
But you're going exactly to where I want to go, right? which is. We have been misled here in the Virgin Islands about focusing on the eye.
Right.
Right?
Absolutely.
I'm dead serious about this, right?
Yes.
We were, for instance, when I got into studying hurricanes, after we got hit by Hugo, and then I got into the tracking thing and all that stuff, there are a number of us here, and a lot of people that actually like tracking storms, because we just want to know where we are, expectation with respect to the major intents, the hits and all that stuff, right? Mm-hmm. We focus so much on the eye And there's right. so much activity in the four different quadrants, depending on where the eye hits, right? Mm-hmm. For example, the reason why I brought up Irene, if Irene's eye hits Brooklyn, right? That means that New England is going to get touched up. Connecticut, Massachusetts, what have you, because you're in the Northeast quadrant. And we learned from one of our hurricane experts. He passed away this year. His name was Herb Schaumbaum. He said, whatever you do, historically, that Northeast quadrant of the storm is where a lot of the rain is because of the counterclockwise movement of the storm, right?
So the reason why not only the rain, but you think about a storm has two movements. One is the sort of circular whirlwind movement of the wind, but it's also moving forward. So in the Northeast quadrant, you get double hit. You get the speed of the hurricane as it's moving forward added to the wind speed of the actual hurricane.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the winds are the greatest and the rain's the greatest. And also the right side of the hurricane is where the storm surge is the greatest. So, yeah, it's no consolation if you're in the Virgin Islands or anywhere that the eye of a hurricane doesn't go over your area if you're within 30 or 40 or 100 miles of the right side or even the left side of a major hurricane, you're in trouble.
I mean, I'm just glad you went there because the more you talk, now storms are coming back to me, right? We got hit with Hurricane Hugo in 1989. That was major devastation here in the territory. It also moved its way to Puerto Rico, and then it devastated Charleston, South Carolina as well, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then 6 years later, prior to us getting hit by Maryland, there was a storm by the name of Hurricane Louis, right?
Okay.
And we were actually in panic here because we were dealing mentally with the devastation of Hugo still being fresh. And and the thing about Louis that I wanted to talk about that you just referenced is it was 400 miles in circumference.
Wow.
Which means 200 miles from the center in every direction, right?
Yeah.
And the size of storms has also got to be factored in, not just the intensity, not just the speed, the size of the storm, because that speaks to how long you're going to be subjected to the system.
Yep.
And when a storm, it crushed Antigua, I remember that, and then it moved off to the north, and, you know, we were all happy and all that stuff. Next thing you know, 10 days later, Maryland comes in and does a number on St. Thomas, and, you know, we get hit here on St. Croix as well. But the thing that I wanted to talk to you about with respect to your studying storms is you said five a century in the Northeast, and there's a reason for that, because it's traveling so far, and don't you get cooler waters the more north the storms traverse?
Exactly. Yeah, one of the hurricane killers is cold water, because the main source of energy for a hurricane is warm water to depth, usually the trigger temperature of 80 degrees Fahrenheit down to about 150 feet, and also you have to have a lot of moisture, warm moisture rising off of the ocean surface, because as that moisture rises, it condenses, forming clouds, and in that process, it releases something called the latent heat of condensation, which is a lot of energy that helps to fuel the storm. So if a hurricane goes over cold water, it definitely gets sapped of strength, or if it goes over land, then that tends to knock hurricanes down to tropical storms or just bad storms. But what I think you're getting at, which is absolutely is happening, there's clear proof. You know, people can argue whether there's global warming or not. I don't know how people argue against it. But we have so much data about ocean temperatures that have increased. Here in New England, where I am, there are great concerns north of Cape Cod that the water is unusually warm and has been for a number of years. And we're already seeing migrations of lobsters, for example. The lobster industry in Long Island used to be really strong, but the waters have gotten a little too warm for the lobsters, and there's a shell disease that came on. So what's happening is the whole lobster industry is shifting further and further north into Maine and then into Canadian waters. So if you have warmer waters off of New England or off of Cape Hatteras or anywhere along the coast, then it basically is an added fuel source to any hurricane that sweeps up the coast. So if the water's warmer and there's a hurricane that's coming up north like Hurricane Sandy, well, maybe if Hurricane Sandy came up now instead of, you know, back in 2012, or even you go further back for a hurricane, it might have been a little bit stronger, especially if the waters are unusually warm. And we just saw that with Hurricane Laura in the Gulf of Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things meteorologists don't understand very well, and I'm not a meteorologist, by the way, but is rapid intensification. But the thinking is that part of the rapid intensification has to do with the extremely warm temperatures that are in the Gulf of Mexico, and there's just such a pulse of energy that goes into that hurricane that it can ramp up from a Category 2 to a Category 4 in, you know, within a day's time. So I personally believe that the hurricanes in the future, the evidence seems to be pointing to the fact that hurricanes in the future in a warmer world are going to be stronger and wetter, and they might even linger longer. Look what happened with Hurricane Dorian.
In the Bahamas.
I mean, if Hurricane Dorian hadn't essentially stalled in place for almost 40 hours, it was going as fast as somebody can walk, basically. The damage would have been a lot less if it swept through there at 20 miles an hour, but it didn't. And look at Hurricane Harvey. Hurricane Harvey stuck around for almost 40 hours. We had 50 inches in Houston,
mm-hmm.
60 inches in another place in Texas. So even if you only had a Category 1 hurricane, imagine if a Category 1 hurricane just parked itself over one area for a day and a half, 2 days.
That's rain. That's crazy rain.
Yeah, rain. I mean, water is the biggest killer, and it's not just ocean surge. Water from rivers, lakes, landslides. I mean, if your ground is extremely wet already, and then you get another 15, 20 inches, you know, you could have houses sliding off the side of hills.
Well, I could tell you from experience, and you know, my engineer talking about it, right? We've had, I'd say on St. Croix, right? We've had over the last, that's the last 40 years, we've had, I'd say, anywhere from 8 to 10 significant impact with hurricanes. And it would be, a majority of the time, it's rain. David and Frederick in 1979, that was September of 1979, August and September of 1979, they devastated islands down in the lower archipelago, like St. Lucia and Dominica and Guadeloupe and all that stuff. But when you're talking about what happened with Harvey, you just referenced 50 inches in Harvey in Houston, 60 inches in another town. That's 4 to 5 feet high rain. That is crazy.
Yeah.
And Katrina may not have been that high, but it was higher because Louisiana and New Orleans is in a basin, which makes it worse. You see, there's multiple variables involved with respect to how you determine degree of impact. When you're in a basin like New Orleans is, and you know, I'm trying to pronounce it correctly. A lot of people say New Orleans, but I've heard it's New Orleans, right? Like New Orleans is, right? That is crazy. When you think about it, because that means water's running down, levees are breaking. What are you going to do?
Right. Yeah, I mean, that raises a broader issue that people have to think about, and it's planning and zoning and where you put houses and buildings. I mean, it's too – I love New Orleans. I've been there. They're not going to get rid of New Orleans, but to be honest, it's kind of a strange place to put a major city. It averages 6 feet below sea level, and you have to take these massive efforts to protect it from flooding, especially since 1950, they've destroyed nearly 2,000 square miles of marshes in Louisiana. And marshes, as you know, I mean,
they're there for a reason, man.
Yeah, they're nature's shock
absorbers
for surge.
Yeah.
And it's very scary how vulnerable many areas along the coast are. And I don't know, in the Virgin Islands, I've only been in the Virgin Islands once. I read that
where you said you have fond memories of being in the Virgin Islands. When was this?
That was let's see, early 1990s. And I was there for about 6 or 7 days with an old girlfriend.
What time of the year?
When was it exactly? I think it was sometime in the late winter, early spring. It wasn't hurricane time.
Mm-hmm.
But wonderful memories. We camped at Cinnamon Bay Campground.
Oh, man. Yeah, you went to St. John. You went to St. John. I live on St. Croix. A lot of activity. Yeah. We're the biggest island, right? And of course, you know, I always say if you want to live in the Virgin Islands, you live on St. Croix. You want to do business and move around, you go to St. Thomas. But if you want to get lost and don't want anybody to bother you to the point where somebody calls your cell phone and they ask you where you at, your answer is nowhere to be found because you're in Cinnamon Bay. You're in Cinnamon Bay and certain parts of St. John. You can get lost in St. John, and it's beautiful over there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It was just absolutely stunningly gorgeous. And we saw St. Thomas for a day or two, but I didn't make it to St. Croix. I hope to make it back there.
I should hang up the phone right now. Then. That's what you're telling me, right? For hurting my feelings because you didn't make it to St. Croix, right? I should just cut the conversation short. That's what you're telling me, man?
I was a graduate student. I didn't have much money.
Okay. Your excuse. However, that was the early 90s. I'm sorry, but this is 2020. You haven't been back. I got a problem with that.
Well, don't take it so bad. I'm not a particularly well-traveled person. I'm trying to convince my wife as we get older to do more traveling. She's seen a lot of the world. I sort of missed out on that.
Come on down to Paradise whenever you can, you know, put money together and have a wingding and all that stuff. Now, let's talk about another aspect. You have a segment here where you reference a Cuban pastor.
Priest,
Benito Viñez.
Viñez.
Okay. Because it's my understanding that there's a tilde on top of the N. And if that's the case, then it's Viñez, right?
Okay.
And he prayed. He speak about that segment, about what he did as relates to hurricanes and all that stuff.
Well, he's a fascinating character. He's a Jesuit priest. And there in Cuba, there was an observatory called the Belin, I don't know exactly how to pronounce it, observatory that for many years had been taking weather measurements, and they had, but the records were in really bad shape. But he was somebody, we don't have a lot of information about his early education, but before he made it to Cuba, he clearly was very knowledgeable about science, and his particular interest was meteorology. He had read a lot of the books, especially that came out in the mid-1800s that talked about hurricane formation and sort of started to give us our general idea of what hurricanes are all about. And so he made it to Cuba, and the first thing he did is he took all the old records at the observatory and organized them so they could be used as a database. And then he got some scientific instruments like very high-grade barometers and anemometers and other devices that would allow him to measure different aspects of the weather. He also created a network of people throughout Cuba and actually some of the other islands to provide him with data on storms and various weather phenomena that comes through. And he was, no pun intended, he was religious about measuring this stuff. And sometimes 5 or 10 times a day, he would go out and take measurements, record all of it. And what he started to see were patterns in nature. And he actually wrote a very well-regarded book at the time, which was on West Indian hurricanes, cyclones. And he sort of talked about some of the things that Columbus already knew about back then, you know, the red sky in the morning, the high cirrus clouds, the long, deep swells, and the low barometric pressure. And he put all of these things together, and he used his own intuition and just knowledge of the world to predict and forecast hurricanes. Now, he made a number of mistakes, just like any meteorologist would, but he was particularly adept at reading nature's signs and the measurements and accurately predicting hurricanes before they hit Cuba. And he actually saved many lives because he would put out a warning, and then they would keep all the ships in the harbor in Havana instead of going out towards the east. So he was really a seminal figure in Cuban history. And in the United States, he was well-respected. Unfortunately, the Cuban meteorologists, right up until almost 1900, the Americans started to ignore the information coming from Cuba, and that created a real problem when it came to the Galveston hurricane of 1900,
mm-hmm.
because the Cuban meteorologists had better information about where this hurricane was going, but their information, they were being cut off by the United States, who
when you read about
condescending, go ahead.
You said that America was condescending towards Cuba.
Oh, yeah. Well, come on. America's history is full of times when we were condescending towards all sorts of countries and anybody else.
Definitely.
So, but back we're gonna take, in particular.
Yeah, we're going to take the final break in this hour with Mr. Eric J. Dolan. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about the Bellin Observatory, that is actually one that exists in South Florida, in Miami. And then from there, we'll talk some more about local hurricanes and a little bit about Sandy and how politics comes into the mix with these storms as well. Analyze this here on a Paradise Tuesday, September 1st, 2020. We'll be back right after this.
Facial coverings can simply be uncomfortable and can make breathing difficult. The CDC and the government of the U.S. Virgin Islands recommend using masks when you are out in public to stop the spread of COVID-19. Wearing a mask is a requirement to enter any business in the USVI. Use your mask safely with appropriate hand hygiene. Check for holes or tears. Cover your face and mouth snugly. Make sure you can breathe easily. And be extra careful not to touch the front of your mask and any part of your face while removing it. Wash your hands and your mask after each use. And when you can, please stay at home and leave only for brief and essential errands. Avoid going out on really hot days when breathing can be difficult. Use a cloth mask or homemade covering made of light, breathable fabric. And take a break if you are ever feeling breathless. Remember, masks protect you and they protect others. As we all work together to fight COVID-19, tell your friends, tell your family, and remind our visitors that no mask means no service.
Let's be prepared this hurricane season. Ensure emergency alerts are enabled on your cell phone. Listen to trusted news sources like local radio and television stations. Read online and print newspapers and follow social media pages. If you're in a flood zone, plan an evacuation route and listen to local authorities if you're asked to evacuate. Make a plan, get a kit, stay informed, and help your neighbors. This message has been brought to you by the Virgin Islands Department of Health. Visit their website at doh.vi.gov.
Back, final segment here on the first day of September 2020, and we're talking hurricanes with Mr. Eric J. Dolan, currently in Marblehead, Massachusetts, up there in New England, and his book, A Furious Sky, The 500-Year History of America's Hurricanes, and we're talking about the Bellin Observatory. It's a Jesuit school, and there's one in Miami right now, and they got a nice picture here on the website with the gentlemen, pretty much high school kids and all that stuff. They got on the preppy blue jackets with the khaki pants and the white shirt and the tie, looking real spiffy and all that. So I just wanted to touch about that. And Father Benito Vinyes, he's a Cuban, right? And they actually study astronomy. They have a certain telescope at the Bellin Observatory that nobody else has, that they can see stars and all stuff. So maybe he was using the stars as a way of determining, you know, how weather is going to impact Cuba and hit the world. You never know.
I didn't come across anything about him using the stars, but I'll grant you, you never know.
No, I said maybe. I don't know. I don't know that for a fact. You know, I'm learning as we go. Now, I mentioned politics, right?
Yep.
The most infamous hug in the history of modern American politics was when President Obama, right before the 2012 election, flies up to New Jersey, because New Jersey had been devastated by Hurricane Sandy, and President Obama is a Democrat, and Chris Christie is a Republican, and when they come off the plane, they hug, and the people talked about it for 2 days. It was a genuine, I feel for you type of thing, and the next thing you know, people are saying, oh, wait a minute, Obama got votes, that's the reason why he won 8 out of 9 swing states, and went on to get reelected, winning over Mitt Romney. Politics is very, very important with respect to hurricanes, because FEMA right?
Oh, yeah.
Federal. Seriously, people don't understand. People don't understand this, but the Federal Emergency Management Agency pretty much is a hurricane for most of us on this side. But it's really a storm financing vehicle to allow for you to recover. That's what it is.
Right, and politics definitely have affected FEMA's history in a major way, because during certain administrations, it was a dumping ground for political patronage, and the people who were running it were not that effective as emergency managers. Mm-hmm. Plus, it depends on federal funding. In some years, it gets great funding, and other years, it gets anemic funding. So politics has a great impact on hurricanes, not only hurricane relief and after the fact, but politics plays a role before hurricanes even come to town, because it affects zoning decisions and public finance priorities and evacuation plans and lots of stuff. It was a shame. Yeah, that hug with Obama, I mean, wouldn't it be nice to live in a world where when there's a disaster, the main goal is just to help people.
Yeah, man.
And not whether it's Democrat or Republican.
Exactly. And in this case, you had a Democratic president and a Republican governor. And yeah, people will say, well, why would he do that? Well, why wouldn't he do that? He's hurting. He's the governor of a state. He's lost a number of his constituents. This is human life we're talking about. Certain areas are devastated, not going to recover for months, if not a year or more. He has a right to feel the need for some type of comforting, and that's what took place, and that was real. If there's something that I like, that was politically incorrect, and there's a time when political incorrectness is absolutely appropriate.
Yeah, I mean, basic humanity should rule a lot of people's decisions, and unfortunately, that's not the case.
Okay, often. Good. I like that. Now let's talk a little bit about Hurricane Hunters. That came about that came about because of a bet, right?
Yeah. Yeah, there was a guy, basically this guy named Joseph Duckworth, who was in the Navy in the early 1940s, and he was the chief flying officer at Bryan, Texas, the Air Force Base. But he formerly was a pilot with Eastern Airlines, and in the end of the 1920s, pilots started to learn how to do instrument flying, which is different from contact flying. Contact flying is when you sort of can look down and see landmarks on the earth to help guide you. But instrument flying is when you're in pea soup fog or in clouds and can't see anything, can't see the horizon, but you still want to fly. So he was an expert in that. And during World War II, he decided it was really important to teach Air Force flyers how to fly by their instruments and not by what they see. So he used to teach them on these AT-6 Texans, which are small two-seater planes. And there was, in 1943, there was a hurricane coming into Galveston off the Gulf Coast. And the brass at the Air Force Base was talking about moving all the AT-6 Texans further inland to protect them from the hurricane's wrath. And at the time, there were a bunch of British flying aces who were at the facility learning how to fly better. And they started making fun of Joseph Duckworth and the other Americans, saying, hey, when a major thunderstorm hits the British Isles, we don't move our planes. They're tougher than that. We keep them on the tarmac. You tie them down. You know, what are these flimsy Texan planes? And so Duckworth, you know, sort of looked over at these British flying aces and said, first of all, you don't understand what a hurricane is. It's not just a bad thunderstorm. And second of all, these planes are pretty tough. And you know what? I'm going to prove it. I'm going to fly into this hurricane and fly back. And if I do successfully, the winner, you know, basically if I do it successfully, you guys are going to buy me a drink. So he grabbed the navigator to hop in the plane with him. He went off, and while he was heading towards the hurricane, the air tower in, I think it was Houston, said sort of radioed and said, where are you going? And they said, we're going, you know, towards Galveston. And the guy said, don't you know there's a hurricane coming in right now? And they said, yeah. He goes, oh, tell me your name again. I want to have a record in case you don't come back. So Duckworth and his navigator went into the plane. They didn't into the hurricane. They didn't plan to go into the eye. They were just going to go into the edge of the hurricane and then come back.
Mm-hmm.
But before they knew it, they broke into the eye, the calm, beautiful eye of the hurricane. And then they came back, and he landed successfully. And the weather officer at the Air Force Base was really annoyed because he wanted to be taken along. So he convinced Duckworth to go up a second time, and this time they took a bunch of notes about the hurricane and took some measurements. But that night at the officer's club, the British Flying Aces bought their fearless leader, Joseph Duckworth, a highball or a drink of his choice, because he had successfully gone into the hurricane. And that's what started
the genesis of Hurricane Hunters?
Yeah, because suddenly he had proved indisputably that you could fly into a hurricane and fly back out. And actually, we've had Hurricane Hunter flights on a serious basis since the 1950s, probably thousands, many thousands of them at this point.
But they actually parked their jets here on St. Croix.
Yeah,
they parked the planes on St. Croix.
One Hurricane Hunter said that the most dangerous part of his day is driving to the airbase and climbing the ladder into the plane.
Wow.
Because after all of those flights, only 6 Hurricane Hunter planes have been lost. And 5 of them were in the Pacific, measuring typhoons, which are just hurricanes by another name. There's only been one Hurricane Hunter in the Atlantic that went down during Hurricane Janet. So despite the fact that sometimes it's what they call a hairy hop or a rough ride, and you can really get hurt. And there are examples of Hurricane Hunters being buffeted by the winds and people on board being seriously injured, but the plane not going down. So it's not a cakewalk, but, you know, if you're a good pilot, and these people are excellent pilots, and you're in a good plane, you can survive going into a hurricane. And that's good for us because Hurricane Hunter planes, even with satellites, Hurricane Hunter planes provide a lot of excellent real-time information that allows meteorologists to alert us to the coming hurricane and how strong it is and where it's going.
We had never experienced an eye truly over the island until Hurricane Hugo. And I'll explain it to you this way, right? Hurricane Hugo stopped. It came over St. Croix, and it was moving at about 8 miles an hour.
Wow.
And here's what happened, right? We're at home holding doors together, everything like that, right? Mm-hmm. And then at about 1:30, 2 a.m., everything stops. So we're thinking it's over. And then 45 minutes to an hour later, it starts back up again.
Yeah.
That's the experience of an eye, because the eye really is a calm area of the storm. And
yeah.
And so to hear you speaking about Duckworth, pilot Duckworth or officer Duckworth,
yeah,
whatever he was, and actually experiencing that, and then we see the video of the Hurricane Hunters going over the storm and dropping the instrument into the eye,
right,
and all that stuff to find out barometric pressure, what have you. It's really amazing how we have, you know, grown and evolved in terms of how to judge and measure intensification, location, what have you. And for what happens here is, if we are expected to be hit by the storm, they move the planes, and they go down to Aruba. They go like way south, down towards Aruba, Bonaire, and Curacao.
Right.
They're right there off the coast of South America. And they park them there. I guess they have some arrangement with all that stuff, and then they come back up and do what they have to do. But it's interesting.
Actually, to be fair, I mean, that makes sense. I mean, a hurricane comes by, and you have planes on a tarmac, and you get hit by the hurricane. It's very different than flying into a hurricane. And, a lot of planes, there are examples during Hurricane Andrew. There was an airport that got smacked, and I think
Homestead.
Over 100 planes were thrown around like toys.
Yeah, that was in Homestead.
So,
that was in South Florida, down in Homestead and Paraina, down that area. Yeah, there's an Air Force base, I think it was, that's down in South Florida that got devastated.
But there's also, there might have been Air Force. That is Florida. But there was also apparently one of these airfields. I can't remember the name of it. I think it was called Tamiami.
Yeah, Tamiami. Yeah, right there.
And a bunch of antique planes, which are smaller, got destroyed, and private jets in particular. So Duckworth wasn't being completely upfront. I mean, an AT-6 Texan is a small plane. If you have 100-mile-an-hour winds going over the tarmac,
they'll pick that up.
You bolt planes down, they're going to fly.
Or they'll pick that up and make that plane a rag doll real quick.
Yeah.
Real quick. Now, the final area of discussion before we leave is here in the Virgin Islands, right? We've had a situation where a number of storms actually passed here as a depression or a tropical storm and evolved into a real hurricane. Like, for instance, Jean, 2004, actually formed right here. Dorian. Mm-hmm. Dorian, that you referenced, that the storm that did significant damage in the Bahamas, that became a hurricane right off the coast of St. Thomas, where it actually intensified. So I wanted to speak, and with Laura, right? Laura, you know, she moved by here, and then she actually skirted Cuba. She went, like, due west and then turned north and went up to Louisiana and Texas. Right. So you were talking about meteorologists. One of the things I had a discussion with one last week, Mr. Colon, or no, Mr. Jose Alemán, and the uncertainty with storms is even more prevalent now than in the past, notwithstanding how sophisticated we are. Because, you know, Laura was expected to pass 80, 90 miles to the northeast in St. John. She passed 60 miles south. That's a significant, south of St. Croix. And we're 40, 45 miles south of St. John. So that speaks to uncertainty. And there has to be something to this global warming. That's just my take.
Yeah, well, maybe, but the real point is, and you're absolutely right, is hurricanes are very complex meteorological beasts, and there are a lot of factors that go into determining where they're going to go and how strong they're going to get. And despite our ability to track them with satellites, we could see them, our computer models are very sophisticated, but they are not perfect, and there are always surprises that hurricanes are going to throw at you. So that's why we have this large cone of uncertainty, because they're not quite sure where the eye is going to track in the rest of the storm. There are going to continue to be surprises. And unfortunately, there's nothing we as humans can do to keep the hurricanes from coming. We can only better prepare for them and then better deal with the aftermath.
Eric J. Dolan, out of Massachusetts, the name of the book, A Furious Sky, the 500-year history of America's hurricanes. And of course, where he lives, they get five a century. So, you know, they're fortunate up there. We don't have that luxury. But it starts somewhere, and, you know, coming off the coast of Africa and working its way across the Atlantic, working its way through the Caribbean basin, up the shorelines. And then, of course, you know, we got the Cape Hatteras and the Outer Banks of North Carolina. That's a point of direction in terms of, you know, where you look at storms and all that. And we're glad to have you on today. Good luck with the book.
Thank you.
And I'm sure, let's hope that we don't have to talk to you about a hurricane sometime during the remainder of the 2020 hurricane season.
I hope not.
Good. And good luck. And you have other books as well, Black Flags, Blue Waters.
This is my 14th book. Yeah, I've got a book about whaling that might be of particular interest down there.
Leviathan.
Fur trade, lighthouses, you know, stuff.
Okay, good. When America First Met China.
Yep.
An exotic history of tea, drugs, and money in the age of sail. Wow. We got to get you back on again sometime in the future, Mr. Dolan. Okay?
Okay.
Thank you very much, and good luck with A Furious Sky.
I appreciate it.
Okay, good.
Thank you very much.
You got it. That's Mr. Eric J. Dolan out of New England, and A Furious Sky, the 500-year history of America's hurricanes. Of course, you know, this is September, and we're going to try to stay ahead of the curve. Here, yesterday we had on the Vitima director, and we were supposed to get some solid rain over the last couple of days. It didn't materialize, somewhat like what happened with Josephine. And then I just look at the 10-day window, and we're not supposed to get any rain, which means we're going to get rain. And whatever they tell you, think the opposite, okay? When rain's supposed to come, it looks like it ain't want to come. But when it's supposed to rain coming. And that's what we're dealing with that. Okay? So, great show today. Thank you, Ronnie Russell, as we broke down the situation with the governors, 33-0363. That's the securitization, corporation, creation, right? Securitization, corporation, creation bill. And then the authorization that the governor so needs from the legislature to go and cut the deal, so to speak. And then at some point, we're going to get into the discussion about the credit rating, because the public needs to have a better understanding, including myself, about Moody's and all that stuff. Another show in the books. Back tomorrow. The candidates speak. Recognize Genevieve Whitaker, is on the mic. Talk to you then.
The views and opinions expressed on Analyze This are entirely those of the on-air participants and do not reflect that of the station's board, management, staff, or underwriters.